Welcome along to this very special bonus podcast on your bolts.ie feed, where we're talking books, specifically World in Motion, the inside story of Italia 90 by Simon Hart. It's published by De Coubertin Books, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and it's just out now. We're delighted to say that Simon joins us on the line. Thanks for joining us, Simon.
No, thanks for having me.
Firstly, how did this book come about?
How did it begin? Well, we were looking at the fact the 30-year anniversary of the 90 World Cup's coming up, you know, in a couple of years' time. And with this being a World Cup year, we just, I suppose, thought we'd get in there early, really, and, you know, look back on a tournament which, you know, had such a big impact in England and Ireland. And as, you know, as the research and the interviews unfolded with the book, I sort of realised just what a big impact it had, you know, elsewhere in the world. So that was really fascinating. We think here of Gazza's tears, and I know you have your sort of Paddy Bonner, David O'Leary penalty moments, but, you know, there's a film of Italia 90 in Costa Rica, for example, so you find out just what it meant elsewhere.
Yeah. When I saw the book, I have to say, I assumed that Italia 90 would hold some kind of treasured place in your heart. Does it?
I was 17 at the time, so, you know, the first World Cup I saw was 82 on the telly as a 9-year-old. But by the age of 17, I suppose you're a little bit more aware of everything else that's going on. So it was, you know, a massively exciting summer. You know, just to suddenly see an England team which could compete with, you know, the best teams in the world after that exile, you know, for our club teams from Europe for 5 years. It was just a really, really exciting time.
The tournament is obviously very fondly remembered in this part of the world and in a number of other countries like the States and like Cameroon and like Costa Rica. How did you find going back to it now with a fresh pair of eyes compared to how you experienced it as live in 1990? Because in terms of an aesthetic aesthetically, it wasn't the greatest tournament in the world.
No, you're right. I rewatched quite a number of games, including, of course, that famous opening match between Cameroon and Argentina.
Yeah.
And that match in particular kind of stands out because, I suppose, for the sheer brutality of the way the Cameroonians were getting stuck into Maradona, and then when Caniggia came on, you know, the first four times he actually picked up the ball and ran, he got booted. And this obviously, you know, ended with that famous red card for Benjamin Massing, who hit him so hard that his boot flew up in the air. So I suppose the fouls was something which stands out, and also the way players responded to being kicked, because Maradona, you know, by today's standards, is pretty stoical about the whole thing. He sort of, you know, gets up with a weary shrug. He got kicked by the Cameroonians. So that was, of course, you also had the back pass. So it was a slower game. Yeah. But it was interesting watching, you know, some of the very individually talented players, the way they'd pick up the ball and run with it. So I don't know if it was more a game about individual players, you know, shining on their own. Toto Scarlatti, who I spoke to, seemed to suggest that nowadays, you know, teams attack and defend together and do it all at high pace, whereas back then, I suppose, you'd see individual talents get on the ball and try and do something with it, try and beat a man. And the game would kind of work the way it would feel that way.
Yeah. And do you think that's changed in World Cups recently, that it is more about the collective than the individual?
It's an interesting question, because if you think about you think about the way Maradona single-handedly, well, maybe that's exaggerating it slightly, but the way the huge impact he had on the 86 World Cup, which Argentina won, and I'm trying to think. I mean, the Germany team of the last World Cup, I don't really think one particular individual stamped his name on that tournament from a Germany point of view.
Yeah.
And Argentina had Messi 4 years ago. Each era has its, you know, its heroes and its stories. But I think in 90, there was a real excitement around some of those stories.
Yeah.
You know, they were real outsiders. I mean, Roger Miller had come out of retirement. Scarlatti had really come from nowhere. He'd only played his first game for Italy 3 months before that World Cup. And even Paul Gascoigne had, you know, he hadn't really been a guaranteed starter for England until the spring of 1990. Maybe that's something, at least with that 1990 World Cup, was different. You know, the people who actually wrote the most compelling stories weren't expected to, even sort of 5 or 6 months beforehand.
Yeah, but it was also a time, Simon, that was much easier to come from nowhere. There's a lot less mystery and mystique about football now just because there's so much of it on TV and, you know, you can watch pretty much anything you want on the internet. So that probably fed into that, did it?
No, it did. I mean, one of the many days I spent kind of doing research, I was in the British Library looking through the old TV times and radio times, you know, here in England. And there were 12 live First Division games that season in 89-90. There wasn't a single live European Cup game on TV. So, as you say, to suddenly have a month of TV and a month of all of these players who you'd not seen, you'd not had a chance to see, you know, for 4 years since the previous World Cup, it did bring with it a different level of excitement, I think. You know, what one of the stats that I dug up was that there were only two players playing in Italia 90 who played in the English top division who were born, you know, outside the British Isles. And they were both Swedish internationals, Roland Nielsen and Glenn Hussein. So, you know, whereas nowadays, I think it's almost 100 players at the last World Cup from outside of Britain and Ireland who play in the Premier League and played at the World Cup. So we know so many of them. And so there are, as you say, fewer surprises for us when we switch on a World Cup these days.
Most of us use World Cups as staging posts in our lives, but they're definitely staging posts in football. And by the time USA 94 came around, Simon, the football world was beginning to look very, very different, because within 2 years of Italia 90, we had the Champions League and we had the Premier League, and they're arguably the two most dominant competitions in football at the moment, definitely club football. And the title of the book in full, I should say, is World in Motion, The Inside Story of Italia 90, The Tournament That Changed Football. So I might just tease out a couple of elements of that change, and we'll start with the Premier League and the Champions League. Did Italia 90 have any impact on the foundations of those competitions?
I think that, I mean, yes is the short answer. In terms of the Premier League, it created, I guess, a mood which was much more, I suppose sponsors, marketing people were much more willing to embrace football in this country after Italia 90. I know there were other changes going on, but, you know, you had after the kind of the nadir of the hooligan problems in the mid 80s, 6 days after Italia 90, you had the UEFA confirmed the return of English clubs to its competitions. The Taylor report had come in, obviously in the wake of Hillsborough, so things were changing, but the climate became much more you know, disposed towards football. I think people who weren't football fans stopped and saw, you know, this resurgence of the sport's popularity in the wake of England reaching the semi-finals. So there was clearly, you know, things were falling into place. Satellite TV was coming, so, and Sky B as it was needed a sport really to probably to keep it alive, because it struggled in the first couple of years. But the climate around football in the wake of Italia 90 was so much more positive. In terms of the Champions League, I think Italia 90 gave us an image of football as this kind of huge television spectacle. You know, we had the operatic music with Pavarotti. And I spoke to somebody who was involved in creating the look of Italia 90. And a lot of those executives then moved on to work with UEFA on the Champions League. So, you know, you end up with this Champions League anthem, where they were basically, you know, seeing the impact of the opera in Italia 90 and thinking, you know, we can do something similar with this newly revamped European Cup. So I do think, you know, that there was a big influence.
And Berlusconi is credited as being one of the main engineers behind the Champions League when he looked at Real Madrid and Napoli taking on each other in the early rounds of the European Cup, and one of them only being guaranteed two games. So I guess the fact that he was in Italy at this time possibly helped the acceleration of the Champions League as well.
Well, I Scone's you know, he I spoke to somebody who was involved in Berlusconi's kind of early study. You know, he did some research into the feasibility of a European Super League, and I think that possibly spooked UEFA, you know, into then doing what it did, and you know, wanting to keep hold of its competition, and you know, making the changes it did to the European Cup, which created the group stage and that format for the new Champions League. So, and Italy was, of course, the place where to which the stars gravitated at the time. You know, it was probably the epicenter of world football. So anything that was happening in Italy had the attention of everybody else were.
Mm. The journalist Michael Cox wrote a good book about the Premier League called The Mixer. And in his introduction to that book, it talks, you know, like people will say that Sky Sports invented football in 1992, and why do we only really refer to records since then? He makes the point that it's probably fair enough to do that because that was the year that the back pass rule was introduced, and that completely revolutionised and changed the game and sped it up. How directly responsible was the fair at Italia 90 for the introduction of the back pass rule?
Yeah, I mean, it was directly responsible. I spoke to Sepp Blatter in Zurich about this, and he remembered attending a UAE game, UAE Colombia, and he was just, you know, he sat there watching back pass after back pass to the UAE goalkeeper, and you know, sat shaking his head and thinking someone had to change here. And you know, for all Blatter's foibles and all of the you know, the mistakes he made, I think one positive from his time with FIFA was to make positive changes in the wake of Italia 90. His technical director at the time, Walter Gag, actually had a conversation with a Swiss coach who was doing some journalism at the time, and they actually between them discussed, I think they had the first discussion, you know, about having changing the back pass rule. So it directly came from there. I mean, I spoke to Thomas Nkono, the Cameroon goalkeeper from the opening match, and he said that, you know, that it was part of their tactics to slow the game down and to kind of grow into the game simply by, you know, passing the ball back to him. And there was something like a dozen back passes in the first half alone of that game. Mm. So, yeah, it people saw that and they wanted the game to change. They wanted they thought negative football or defensive football had taken a hold, and they wanted to shift the balance back. Whether we can, you know, whether it's justified to say the football began in 92, though, I dispute that.
Yeah. Well, you've written a book about football in Italian 90, so I can understand where you're coming from there. Can I briefly break off from the book to ask you, what's Sepp Blatter like?
Well, you could say that he's probably mindful of his legacy when he agrees to speak to journalists now. So, you know, he was so keen to accentuate, you know, the good that came out of you know, the aftermath of 90, and he set up the Task Force 2000 to try and get attacking football back on the agenda. So he was okay. I mean, he obviously, this is somebody who loved the limelight. So, you know, even when he was sitting with me, you know, he was making jokes. At one point, he even mimicked Maradona sniffing cocaine, which you don't really expect to happen in an interview with Sepp Blatter, but you know, that's exactly what he did.
I get the impression that Blatter wasn't crazy about Maradona. Is that fair?
You could possibly say it was a mutual feeling, really.
Really, yeah.
Well, you know, Maradona thought that the FIFA were conspiring against him in that World Cup. You know, some of his statements during that World Cup were just, you know, compared to today's, you know, media trained footballers, they're just extraordinary. We're talking about this black handed work and how the whole world was against Argentina. You know, I spoke to the referee at the World Cup final, the Mexican referee who ended up sending off two Argentina players and giving a very dodgy penalty to Germany, which won the game. And he insisted that it wasn't fixed. Well, clearly he wouldn't say anything else, yeah. But you know, there were strong rumours at the time that he'd been told that Argentina couldn't win that game.
Yeah, okay. I'll move off Sepp in just a minute, Simon, but can I take you back to the moment that Sepp Blatter pretends to snort cocaine? How do you respond to that? Is it a kind of an awkward laugh, or can you remember what he said?
No, yeah, you're absolutely right. A little bit of awkward laughter. But no, the context was he was talking. I asked him about Maradona's, you know, claims about this conspiracy against Argentina, and he then said Maradona was a very difficult man. I remember being with him in Barcelona at the 92 Olympics when he was trying to kind of persuade FIFA to end, you know, the ban he'd been given for taking cocaine, or to shorten it. And that, he said in the room it must have been very cold with the air conditioning, because Maradona kept sniffing, and at that point, you know, he did the gesture of you know, snorting cocaine, which,
oh my god,
we never saw this in one of his press conferences, thankfully.
Oh my god, so I can just, because I've always imagined these little FIFA cabals in wood paneled boardrooms in Switzerland, like just joking about each other and, you know, maybe cutting some deals of some kind. You don't ever imagine them actually talking with the footballers. So I can imagine what they actually do in the privacy of their own little wood paneled boardrooms. But anyway, that's my own digression.
Yeah.
Can I ask about, like, what you tell really well in the book are the stories of, while Italian 90 wasn't one for the purists, shall we say, it was year zero and marks an explosion for the sport in a number of countries whose first World Cup it was. So obviously we know lots about Ireland over here. You explore Costa Rica and Cameroon very well as well. And this is a tension that was brought up by Euro 2016 and will now be brought up by a 48-team World Cup, is where you open it up to more countries. Now, there are political benefits for the whoever happens to be the incumbent president at the time. We'll leave them aside for one moment. You open up the tournaments, you lower the overall standard of the tournament, but as we saw in Euro 2016, for the likes of Iceland and Wales and others, it's a really, really important thing to happen and a really, really memorable point in the nation's history, not just their sporting history. So can I ask you, what's your opinion of the 48-team World Cup that we may see at Qatar and we're definitely going to see 4 years later?
I'm probably a little bit of a traditionalist. You know, it's funny when you look back and you, I was reading about, you know, I read a lot of archive material on Italian 90 where you had journalists complaining about the 2014 World Cup being too big and, you know, the unwieldy format, which led to lots of dull group games. And, you know, lo and behold, you get a 2014 Euro and exactly the same thing happens. So 48, is it in the interest of developing the sport? Is it in the interests of just having a huge television spectacle, which will obviously bring in more revenues? I don't think it's nothing to do with quality, as far as I can see. And I think we definitely saw the impact on the Euro 2 years ago, where the quality, you know, dipped with the expansion of teams.
Yeah. Just a couple of other things to tease out in terms of how it changed football. One thing I was really interested in, you mentioned with United Arab Emirates getting their first taste of the World Cup. And you say that they gained an understanding of the sport's soft power through this appearance. Now, the modern football landscape today is largely, if not completely, defined at the top level by sponsorship from Qatar and Abu Dhabi. Is it too simplistic to bring all that back to Italia 90? Is that your dot in terms of all this happening? Or what kind of role has it played on Neymar costing 222 million euros and Manchester City winning the Premier League with 100 points?
It's probably too simplistic, but I think it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting kind of little avenue to pursue on the side. I just found it fascinating to, when I sat down with this a couple of people when I went over to Abu Dhabi, and you know, I heard the story that they'd in the embassy in Rome, the United Arab Emirates embassy over there, they'd really struggled to make simple contacts with people in Italy. But the moment the national team qualified for that World Cup, they just found doors opening up to them. And given that this was the first World Cup for the UAE, I don't think it's exaggerating the point to say it would be the first time that they'd have, you know, they'd have been aware of football's power, you know, and the soft power it could bring them. Clearly, they, you know, a lot of different steps have been taken between then and now, But it's I think I was pretty, you know, intrigued by that tale. And you know, today the power they have is extraordinary. You know, if you compare it to their actual contribution, you know, in a sporting sense to world football.
Just a couple of final questions then, Simon. The heft of the research is extraordinary. And you mentioned you watched back a few games. You didn't watch Ireland-Egypt, did you?
Well, I'd like to tell you I did, but even I have you know, my limits. So I couldn't bring myself to watch that one.
You did watch Ireland. You see me watch Ireland-England. There's an amazing opening. I'm flicking through the book now because the introductory line is absolutely fantastic. The rain came down in Cagliari. Occasionally, so too did the ball. As casting your critical eye over Ireland at that tournament now, in 2018, where we can get away from the pen-throwing hysterics of Eamon Dunphy, as you go into very well in the book, what did you make of us?
I'll say something nice. I watched the Romania game in its entirety, and I thought that Ireland actually, once they got the ball forward, they actually, you know, played some nice football in the Romania half, kind of with some of the triangles they played to kind of work the ball around the pitch, with, you know, very good technical footballers in midfield, with people like Kevin Sheedy, and, you know, Paul McGrath. You mean, there were clearly good footballers on that pitch. So that's me being nice. You know, I saw some good football in that game. You know, Tony Cascarino did kind of, you know, have a good laugh about this, saying, you know, most of the games were rubbish and we didn't even win a game. And yet, you know, the Ireland's biggest footballing heroes ever. But yeah, I mean, some of the games clearly weren't as good as, you know, we might expect to see today. So yeah.
As I mentioned, the heft of the research is great. There's something like 100 interviews conducted in the book all across the world. Which of these interviews are the most memorable? Like, who? Let me see. What's the best way of phrasing this? Who turned out to be completely different than you expected them to?
I mean, Benjamin Massing, who he sadly passed away since I met him. You know, he was the huge Cameroonian centre back who, you know, he was the man who booted Caneja up in the air, and he will always be remembered for probably the funniest foul, you know, in World Cup history. And he was just this lovely kind of gentle giant. And he'd become a chief for the people in his Adeo, where he lived in Cameroon. On the day I met him, he was at a chief's meeting. He had this necklace with lion's teeth on it, and it was a perfect kind of scenario for an interview. So much colour, and he was such a lovely fellow. So he probably you know, exceeded expectations. I'm just trying to think who else. Roger Miller was pretty grumpy. Which, you know, it's daunting enough kind of walking into the house of, you know, this World Cup legend, and when he begins by grumbling at you because he thought I worked for FIFA, and he doesn't like the new FIFA kind of in the post.
Ah, right.
The post Blatter years. So he had a big moan at me. So once he'd calmed down, that was, you know, that was a pleasure. Goycochea, the Argentina goalkeeper, was great. He actually has a restaurant called Italia 90 on the outskirts of Buenos Aires. He had some great stories about Maradona. You know, he remembered Maradona injecting himself into his toe before the Argentina-Brazil game. And he explained how, because Goycochea was the hero of their penalty shootouts against first Yugoslavia in the quarters and then Italy. And he actually took a pee on the pitch before those two games, which is, you know, incredible to think that a player can get away with that in, you know, in a World Cup semi-final. So they were some of the highlights. And Toto Scarlatti was, you know, a real pleasure to sit down with him in Palermo. You know, he looks very well today. That was probably one of the biggest surprises, just how well he looks, because he probably looks younger today than he does than he did 28 years ago, you know, several transplants later.
Simon Hare, thanks so much for joining us. This is great. World in Motion, the inside story of Italia 90, the tournament that changed football, published by De Coubertin Books, is available now and is highly recommended. Simon, thanks so much for chatting to us today.